Okay, well, right, so I guess I'll introduce Jenny. Thanks much for coming out on, even on a holiday. We have here Dr. Jenny Yant, and she is from Wisconsin, where she's a monstrous Green Bay Packers fan, of course. Of course.
Hey, no!
And was an undergrad and grad student at Wisconsin-Madison, right?
Mm-hmm.
Served first as a master's student there. And so have you been working with Bob Jean since you were an undergrad, maybe?
I started working with him right around the time I started, right before I graduated.
Yeah, so got a master's there and then a PhD with with Anna Dornhaus at Arizona, and now is a postdoc there. And she's here working with me and also Sarah Bengston on a paper with Anna and Jonathan Pruitt and Nigel Rain on behavioral syndromes and how they might relate to social insects, where we're looking to see what insights that are new, not just the same old thing with a new name, but what are new insights from behavioral syndromes for social insects, but also how the long history of work on social insects may have insights for behavioral syndromes that would help that field progress. And so we've got a big outline, and we're working together for 3 or 4 days of just sitting and thinking and talking and et cetera. But while she was here, she wanted to give a seminar, and she is around for, actually, I'm just going to hang out with a few of the grad students this evening. So anyone else who wants to join in on that, where, if nothing else, she can tell you an amazingly cool blowfly
story.
Botfly. Botfly story. Botfly story is always amazing. So, Jenny, take it away.
Thanks, Andy. So actually what I'm going to talk to you about today is essentially what made me really interested in doing this collaboration with Andy and Sarah and everyone else.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
That seem okay? Yeah.
And what I'm going to talk about today is, I'm not even going to use the term behavioral syndrome. I'm going to refer to within colony variation. But I think a lot of you guys are familiar with behavioral syndromes. And so you might start to see different patterns, different correlations that are popping up. And these correlations, these patterns that I've been working with, that I've been observing in my bumblebees while I was doing my PhD at the University of Arizona, are basically what led me to start thinking one step further. Why is all of this variation there? And what are the correlations? What are the mechanisms? But I'm not going to get too much into that today. What I'm going to do instead is take a step back and just describe for you some of the really interesting patterns that I was able to discover and parse out with bumblebees for the past, I've been working with them for about 6.5 years now with Anna Dornhaus. And before I begin talking about the cool things I'm going to step back even a step further and explain to you why I started studying social insects. And essentially, it's because what you guys are probably most aware of are the foragers. When you're outside, you might see some ants on some nectaries carrying leaf trails or just standing around looking adorable, waiting for the picture to be taken. You might see some wasps visiting your apples, drinking from your soda, or also looking beautiful. And of course, we're mostly familiar with bees and pollinating. And so it was going outside and seeing these animals interacting with their environment, letting me get really close to them while they interacted with their environment, that made me start to ask questions. What are they doing out there? How are they getting along? What exactly is happening inside that nest? And what I came to understand is that we rarely get a chance to observe them inside of the nest. One of the exceptions, of course, are going to be paper wasps, where we can actually look for the eaves of our house and see them playing around in our nest. And so there is a lot of literature now on the interactions, the individual behaviors of paper wasps on the nest. But with regards to bees, I mean, we do know a lot about honeybees, of course, because of all of the research that's been done for hundreds of years. But still, they're inside of these cavities. They're hard to find. You can't just open them up. But when you do open them up, you see these really interesting patterns. So for example, we might observe the assortment of ants inside of their nest, and we see these really neat patterns of where the brood are kept versus where the pupae are kept. We might see these really interesting, consistent hexagonal designs of each nest cell and how almost perfectly equal they are to one another. Or we might just observe the parallel combs that emerge within a honeybee colony. And so most of the work we find within a social insect colony are going to be inside of the nest, and we see a lot of really interesting patterns. But even though we see these patterns, we also know that individuals within this group can vary. So one of the more common examples that we're familiar with is the difference in body size. So for example, in these army ants over here, we have really huge, huge soldiers next to a very small worker. But yet you can see this pattern that they're creating, and they can still create that pattern pretty regularly when they need to. This is actually an ant bridge. This is what they construct if they have to cross over a little pond or something, or puddle. But honeybees, even though they look very similar and they have very similar body sizes, will also vary with regards to the tasks that they're going to specialize on. The most familiar that people are aware of is this age polyethism. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But they can also vary with regards to, if they're both foragers, they might vary with what type of foraging they're doing. This forager here is collecting pollen. This forager here is probably returning with a nectar load. So you see these distinct differences between individuals still. And then even within these paper wasps, again, they all kind of look similar. They all, you know, they don't carry pollen, but there's a distinct difference between the individuals with regards to reproductive status. And often you'll see a linear hierarchy of dominance among those workers. Even though there's a definite queen, there's still differences among those workers. So what I wanted to ask was, how does variation influence colony organization? And then second, I'm going to discuss how variation influences colony performance. So I'm going to go through a few different types of organization that you might see in animal groups. So for example, we might see individuals organized spatially. You can see here all of these elephants are nice in a nice straight line. We might see individuals dividing tasks within the colony. So some individuals might be laying eggs, others might be more likely guarding or foraging. We can also see a reproductive division of labor, and most commonly we think of this in terms of the fact that there's a queen inside of the nest and then her non-reproductive workers or daughters. So with regards to spatial organization, why would this come about? Why would this be important? Often we might see an uneven distribution of resources. So for a fish shoal, for example, some individuals in the front might get better access to food, those in the back might have a better swimming. Those in the middle might have better protection. So there's a benefit and a cost to being at each area of the nest or in the group. The dominant individuals also are going to gain usually better access to better space. So for example, in this grooming group, this individual here is most likely the dominant. He gets groomed and he doesn't have to do any work. That's a pretty sweet spot to be in. And then also this organization may help to decrease within group competition. So what we know from paper wasps is that the dominant individual tends to remain in the center of the nest, usually towards underneath. The subordinates are on the periphery, and if you just kind of put them in a jar and shake them up, they might start fighting with one another, but typically they're going to rearrange themselves and they're just not going to butt heads with one another. So there's a lot of benefit to having this organization. We also observe division of labor in animal groups. So I'm going to be focusing on division of labor in my social insects, where we have some individuals that are more likely to take care of brood, others that are going to be foraging. But we also see this in birds, monkeys, people, division of tasks within the group. And then finally, the reproductive division of labor. Again, I mentioned that we're most commonly familiar with the queen inside of the nest versus her daughters or other individuals. So you usually have 1 to 2 primary reproductives. But then those main reproductives are going to suppress the reproduction of the others. And this also happens like in meerkats and in wolves too. And those others then will stay with the group and help raise the brood, and then they go through that division of labor as I showed you in the previous slide. But if those primary reproductives leave, there might still be a chance that those others that stay in the group have the chance to take over that reproductive role. So the other thing that I thought was really interesting is the fact that you can start combining these different levels of organization to see how they correlate with one another. And what we know is that in many social groups, space use can correlate with division of labor. So with regards to non-reproductive tasks, we know that in temnothorax ants, some individuals stay in certain areas of the nest, and that means that they're going to encounter particular task stimuli, which then will lead them to performing different tasks, either brood care or foraging. We might also see reproductive division of labor. As I mentioned before, the primary egg layers tend to remain in the center of the nest, and those subdominants are going to be pushed to the periphery, where they're going to be more likely to go off and forage. So what happens when you have an unorganized nest? In both of these nests, the brood is typically organized in certain areas versus the pupae, but in bumblebees, it's just, it looks like a complete mess. In fact, right now what we're doing is we're taking some data that we collected a few years ago just to determine exactly how random are the brood dispersed throughout the nest over time. But essentially when you look at it, you see this, you see kind of clumps of larvae, clumps of pupae, different areas of food storage, and the individuals just kind of seem to be haphazardly running around the nest. And you can see this, I mean, this is what the colony looks like when we look straight down into it. You can see these larval clumps, honeypot clumps. The queen never has to get marked because she's always slightly bigger, which is pretty sweet. So if we think about the bumblebee colony cycle, we go through an initial growth phase where a solitary queen, this individual, will found a small cavity and lay her first brood of eggs. And those female offspring then will stay around to raise their sisters, and then eventually this worker population just explodes. So then you go into what's called the ergonomic phase, and your population generally plateaus. It's not gonna get, might get a little bigger, might, you know, fluctuate. And eventually you start to observe workers competing with one another. So you start to see a drop in this level of colony cooperation. And then that is usually a precursor to what's called the queenless phase, and that's when your queen dies. Your new queens will emerge, males will emerge, and they'll both leave, they'll mate, the males will die, all workers will die from the colony, and the colony cycle continues again the next year after those new queens have gotten out of their hibernation state. So I'm gonna organize, as I mentioned before, this talk is organized into two different parts. So I'm going to talk to you about how bumblebees are spatially organized inside of the nest, how they divide labor amongst one another, and how those two interact. And then finally, what is the reproductive division of labor look like? And we're going to be talking about it in terms of that colony cycle when we get to that point. And then second, I'll talk to you about how variation affects colony performance with two specific types of variation that I've observed and were capable of manipulating. And that was in terms of body size differences as well as division of labor. So to start off with the first part, we have a variety of hypotheses with how workers could be organized within their nest. Did you have a question?
It may be important later, but are these single drone maters, male maters, or do they?
In this particular species, yes.
Okay.
They tend to mate usually once, maybe twice.
Okay.
So genetic variation is rarely an issue. So there's two ways in which, there's two hypotheses that we tested here, or competing hypotheses. First, we could see individuals remaining in spatial fidelity zones. And that is, we could have some individuals staying in the center of the nest and others individuals at the periphery, but each individual would tend to have her own area. That means when you look at this graph over here, if we look at the distance from the center of the nest as it increases versus the in-nest area that they're using, the in-nest area would remain about constant, but whereas that distance from the center would vary. On the other hand, we might have individuals remaining in specific distances just from the center of the nest. In that case, we might observe some individuals that have this that stay in the center, they're going to have a very small amount of in-nest area. Whereas you have some individuals that tend to just stay on the periphery, not necessarily certain areas of the periphery. And so we're going to see them having a large in-nest area. So what we did to test this was we marked each individual inside of the nest and then went and recorded the location that individual was in at the same time every day over the course of the entire colony cycle. And what we found was that individuals, this is data from over the course of the entire colony cycle, individuals tended to maintain distances from the center of the nest. So there are some individuals that are more likely at the center, some individuals more likely at the periphery, which was kind of interesting, and we didn't quite understand that. And then we started looking into the division of labor. As I mentioned, individuals can divide tasks, and I told you about brood care versus foraging, but there's a variety of tasks that they could be doing. They could be incubating the pupa, which means warming them. They could be feeding the larva. They could be fanning or thermoregulating inside of the nest. They could be guarding or just standing kind of perching, waiting for someone to come inside. It could be undertaking, which is the removal of a corpse. Or they could be in our foraging arena foraging. And for all of the beautiful bumblebee pictures on flower that exist in the world, this is what I looked at when they were foraging. So I thought I'd share that with you instead. So the division of labor hypotheses that I tested here was that first, age could correlate with division of labor. Now this is a graph that we are pretty familiar with from the honeybee literature, in that as workers increase in their age, they tend to be more likely to shift and perform different tasks. So in what I want you to see here is that younger individuals are gonna be more likely to care for brood, whereas older individuals are gonna be more likely to fan, guard the nest, or forage. We may also see spatial organization correlate with division of labor, as I mentioned earlier, with that occurs in some of those other colonies or other species, which means if we look again from the distance from the center of the nest, and compare the proportion of task performance to task, we might see some individuals that are in the center of the nest more likely to do certain tasks, whereas individuals at the periphery more likely to do others. And then finally, I kind of mentioned that there's body size variation within a bumblebee nest, and I'll get to that in a second, but we could see differences with regards to what size of bees are performing different tasks. So on this axis, I have the different thorax widths that we observe. And so we might see, for example, smaller individuals taking care and nursing, whereas larger individuals are going to be more likely to forage. So my first set of results shows that age doesn't necessarily predict tasks, at least not in the way that's as clear as we might observe in honeybees. In one of our colonies, we did observe that there was a general trend or shift towards foraging as the individual got older. But you can see in the other two colonies, there's a lot of overlap between even the range of ages that perform a task, as well as just the age of each task being performed. So really, age isn't a very strong predictor of what an individual is going to do. We did find that spatial organization correlated with division of labor with two particular tasks. First, this is just the graph again, shown in a different way. This is each individual organized in order of their distance from the center of the colony, plus or minus their standard error. So if we look at that, we first see that workers in the center across all three colonies are more likely to feed the larvae, whereas those at the periphery are going to be more likely to go out and forage. Now, what does this mean? This suggests, actually, that there perhaps is some kind of relationship between where the nurses are and how the larvae get fed, because as I showed you before, those larvae are everywhere inside of the nest. They're not really are concentrated in the center. So we see this wide range of body size in bumblebees. And what we know, actually, from a study that was performed after the one that I just showed you, is that the larvae in the center are actually fed disproportionately more. And that means that the resulting pupa, then, are going to be larger. So you can see here, again, if we go from the center of the nest towards the periphery, this says the number of feedings per larva, and this is pupa size. So now we have a mechanism for how this wide range of variation might occur, simply through organizing individuals and having those nurses concentrated towards the center. We can compare this to honeybees, for example, which again have this a more narrower range of body sizes. And so this would be the range of head width sizes compared to the range of thorax width sizes of bumblebees. And again, because the nest is maybe a little bit more uniform, you don't see as much variation in body sizes as you do in bumblebees. So what does this mean for division of labor? What we found then is that smaller individuals are going to be more likely to take care of, to do the nursing tasks, incubating or feeding larvae, whereas those larger individuals are going to be more likely to fan, guard, forage. And then finally, I looked at the reproduction in workers. As I mentioned before, there's that moment when the queen dies, the workers start arguing with one another, but the workers are actually competing with one another to gain some kind of dominant status in order to be the ones to have a more likely chance to develop their ovaries to lay eggs. And because they haven't mated, they're going to be laying haploid eggs, which then become males. And we can measure the reproductive potential of an individual by removing her from the colony, snipping open her abdomen, and just measuring the largest oocyte in each of her ovaries. And this is my distribution of the best examples of ovary differences. Some of them look really scraggly and awful, but these are my favorite ones. So we can have some individuals that have very small oocytes. Here we have some individuals that usually have maybe one or two, but it's usually pretty big. And I would call that a well-developed worker oocyte compared to the queen. The queen was always the special treat when you're having a bad day. Let's dissect the queen and look at some real ovaries. Glorious. So when we look at the distribution of ovary development within a colony, this is kind of interesting because this is different from related species of bumblebees as well. What we see is this is the two of the three queens that I was able to actually get a solid measurement on. So this is where they would lie if we look at the categories of longest oocyte and the frequency of each. We see that there's actually very few individuals that get a chance to develop those large oocytes, whereas the majority of the workers inside of the nest have very small ones. So what does this mean? Well, actually, we have a couple ideas or a couple hypotheses for how do they get to determine who is going to be the one to do it without having, you know, just going through all that competition. A lot of work showing that the most aggressive one has the better, more developed ovaries. But we also looked at whether age or body size correlated. So on this axis here, we have both thorax width or age. It doesn't matter. I'll show you on different graphs in the next slide. But they could go either way. You could have the oldest or the largest individuals. You might have the smallest or the youngest individuals that have better developed oocytes. And the reason that I have these two competing hypotheses is for two reasons. First, we really didn't know. And second of all, in different social insect groups, there are different patterns that emerge. In some groups, it's one way, in some groups, it's the other way. There may be a correlation with space use. And this was really interesting because the literature I've been focused on was this literature from 1986, who said all of the workers that stay closest to the queen, they're going to be the ones to reproduce. And then in 2004, another suggestion came out, or where they provided some evidence that suggested, no, it's the ones that are farthest from the queen are more likely to reproduce. So we went ahead and tested that. And then finally, we looked at that division of labor again. And if we look at this ergonomic phase, so while the queen is there and she's active, versus after we remove the queen or she dies, and then looking at the proportion of time performing a task, we might see that, there might be a difference between the two categories. So I'm going to mess this up, but one of these categories represents the workers with that develop the larger oocytes, the workers versus the workers with the less well-developed ones. So we may see just a difference between the two types, regardless of whether the queen is there or not, in how they perform a task. We might see just a simple change with the colony phase. Maybe everybody decreases performing a certain task, or we might see some kind of interaction between the two, suggesting that everybody's kind of switching how they're doing it based on their type. So the first thing that we showed was that larger individuals and older individuals were more likely to have well-developed oocytes. And what I think is the most interesting thing here is that the correlation is actually quite strong, but it's not necessarily the oldest, because the oldest is over here with a pretty small oocyte, nor necessarily the largest, even though that one's pretty large. There's all of this variation among large individuals and among old individuals with regards to who is going to be developing their ovaries. So it's not definitely predictive if you just look at the individual. What I think is more interesting is the fact that those individuals that tend to stay further away from the queen are more likely to develop their oocytes. So there's some ideas that maybe the queen is producing some pheromone that they're escaping from. These nests are fairly small. I mean, they really can't escape the queen that well. But just maintaining that distance away from her may be something extra that they need. And then finally, if we look at the way that bees change tasks after the queen dies, we can look at in the dark blue workers with small oocytes, light blue workers that have those larger oocytes. We can see some differences with regards to the what they're doing while the queen is alive. So we know that the workers that are going to end up developing larger oocytes are more likely to be inactive. We might sometimes call them lazy. And then after they die, or after the queen dies, we can see that the workers with larger oocytes tend to stay about as lazy, but the workers with smaller oocytes, they stop working a little bit more. And the workers with that develop larger oocytes, they end up starting taking over some of the more brood care tasks. They actually have a direct investment or a direct fitness or an advantage to wanting to care for those brood. So these are my p-values there. So to wrap up part one, how does variation affect organization? I've shown you that workers within a bumblebee nest are actually organized, and they're organized with regards to the distance to the colony center. I've also shown you that the task they perform correlates with how they are organized over space inside of the nest, as well as their body size. And then finally, ovary development among the workers that occurs after the queen dies, they're not going to develop their ovaries while she's still there, correlates with the task they perform, as well as the distance they maintain to the queen. So we'll go into part two and look at how does this variation. So there's all of these different types of ways that individuals vary, and there's some correlations, but how does this variation actually affect colony performance? And I'm going to look at this with regards to their differences in body size as well as their division of labor. And so as I mentioned before, we see these incredible group patterns that emerge. But the patterns are emerging based on very simple individual rules. And that means that each individual inside of the nest has a very small area that she's concentrating on, and has no idea what the overall picture is going to look like. And yet these patterns emerge. And these individual simple rules, we can take them, we can generalize them, repeat them, and we can create these computer programs to simulate how they make these rules and how they use these simple rules to make these complex patterns. But as I mentioned before, individuals within a group can vary with regards to body size, their behavioral thresholds, or their reproductive status. And here, I want to mention that task threshold, what I'm talking about, is not necessarily the task they perform, but the lowest amount of stimuli required for them to recognize that as a task that needs to be performed. I'll talk more about that in a second. So what is the adaptive value of within group variation? So we talked about bumblebees maintain multiple types of variation in terms of space use, body size, task specialization, which I'm going to refer to now as response thresholds, and reproductive potential. But I'm going to focus on these two with regards to understanding how this variation affects their performance. We talked about how bumblebees vary considerably in body size. And workers respond to a variety of stimuli inside of the nest. And in particular, I want to focus on these two sets of stimuli, fanning or temperature differences, which would result in an individual fanning if it's getting too warm, so they thermoregulate, and undertaking, which is the result of dead individuals or corpses inside of the nest that undertakers would need to respond to and remove. So we know that bees vary in their probability to remove corpses. Right now I'm working on a paper with one of my undergrads, and what we're finding is that larger bees are more successful at removing corpses. They're not necessarily the ones that do it all the time, which is actually interesting and frustrating, but they're typically more successful. So what happens when you... How does within group variation in terms of body size, having that wide range of variation, affect hygienic behavior inside of the nest? And then also we know that bumblebees vary with regards to the temperature that they'll begin fanning. So this was work done in 2002 and 2004, where in Anja Weidenmuller's lab, where she showed that at increasing temperatures, the number of individuals that were responding increased. But then when you look at just different individuals, there was a different range of temperatures that each individual responded to. What I did was I subjected the colonies to temperature increased, and recorded the lowest temperature that each individual began fanning at. And I found this normal distribution across all of the colonies with regards to the distribution of fanning thresholds, I'm calling them. And so then I wondered, well, what happens when group variation in fanning response thresholds is decreased? So how does within group variation in fanning response affect thermal regulation? So to examine this big question, which I'm definitely not going to be able to answer for you today, I broke it down to the smaller question, what happens to colony performance if variation in worker body sizes or task, in this case, fanning thresholds is reduced. And so to manipulate within group variation, most studies or previous studies have attested the adaptive value of looking at these extreme phenotypes, the largest or the smallest or the least, the most likely to respond, the least likely to respond, by removing one of those sides and creating a skewed distribution. I'm looking at this from a different perspective. I'm asking, what is the benefit of having this wide range of variation by removing those extreme phenotypes on both sides and just testing how well the individuals that are in the middle are performing. So to do this, what this would look like and what this did look like in a couple of the colonies, when I reduced the body, or the original distribution of body size or fanning thresholds would look like this. And after I removed individuals, the distribution would look like this, much more narrow range of variation. And to do the whole experiment, what I did was I had three treatment conditions, and I had seven colonies represented within treatment. So that meant I had 21 colonies housed within my office at the University of Arizona over the course of 2 years, which was awesome. And then I got allergic to their bee dander, which was not as awesome, but that's okay. And I did three different treatment conditions. I reduced their body size, I reduced their fanning threshold, or I had a control. So what it looked like was in the first two treatments, I made that variation a bit narrower, and in the control, just kind of reduced the number of individuals. I then did a series of repeated experiments, both to test the thermoregulatory performance as well as the undertaking performance. And I heated the nests and recorded the time it took colonies to return to baseline. So again, I'm looking at whole colony performance. I then also dumped five dead bees inside of the colony and recorded how many dead bees they were capable of removing within 24 hours. So my hypotheses for the thermoregulatory experiment were that I recognized that I was removing some individuals, so I would expect them to take maybe a little bit longer to cool down their colony afterwards. However, so if there was no effect of variation, there should be no difference between treatments. But if variation, particularly behavioral variation, affected how well they thermoregulate, we would expect the threshold reduced colonies to take significantly longer than the rest. And we found when we did the appropriate statistics, that there was actually no difference between treatment. So when we looked at within treatment, there was a little bit of a difference between the pre and post removal with regards to how well the colony cooled down their nest. But there was definitely an increase in how much time it took them to cool down the nest just by removing, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you, when I removed those individuals, I removed 50% of the colony. So I started with 100 individuals, reduced it down to about 50. So when you just have half of the colony left, it's going to take them a little bit longer to cool down the nest. And it didn't really matter which ones I removed. But then I looked at, I actually quantified for each colony, pre and post removal, exactly how much variation in terms of body size and threshold variation actually existed pre and post removal. And I used that using a Levine statistic, and I compared that to the time it took them to cool down colonies. So with the statistics, I controlled for colony, pre and post removal, all of that, and found that there was a significant effect that the, so on this scale, we have, this is a measurement of how much variation inside of the nest. So on this side, we have very low amounts of variation. Here we have a wider range of variation. And this is the time to reduce the temperature to the back to the baseline. And what you see here, so when you have a low amount of variation, it's going to take the colony a little bit longer than if you have a higher amount of behavioral variations left inside the nest. We can compare that to the results from when we reduced the body size treatments as well. Or no, just looking at body size variation inside of these nests. And we see no effect. That body size variation didn't affect thermoregulatory behavior of the colony. And examined the results from the undertaking experiment. Again, null hypothesis suggested that there should be no difference between the treatments, but that when we reduce the variation in terms of body size, we should see the colonies removing less bees from the nest. And actually, what we ended up seeing was there was no difference in the treatments, and in fact, what we expected to see in the size reduced was almost an opposite pattern of what we had expected. So we did the same thing. We examined how the Levine statistic, that measurement of variation, correlated with the number of bees that could be that were removed from the nest. And in and now we're going to focus on this one first. In the when there was less variation inside of the nest, on this side of the graph, individuals actually were capable of removing, or colonies were capable of removing more corpses from the nest than when you had more variation. And remember, when you have more variation, you have larger bees inside of the nest, which I told you were actually better. So this was really interesting for us that, you know, this body, actually reducing the body size or having less body size variation led to more undertaking or better undertaking. And then the other thing that is just crazy is the fact that there was this almost, not quite, correlation between fanning thresholds and corpse removal. And in this case, more behavioral variation in thermoregulatory behavior led to better undertaking behavior. And actually, there's been work done before, and of course I forgot where it is, and I'm still on the prowl to find it again, that actually has shown thermoregulatory behavior and hygienic behavior to be correlated in other social insects. So apparently this shouldn't be as surprising as I thought it was. I still think it's surprising. But to wrap up this second section, what I want to share with you is that I'd like to suggest that within-group variation does affect colony performance in both ways. Threshold variation, I think, has a significant factor on these colonies. So I showed you that variation in fanning thresholds, a wider variation in fanning thresholds, allowed the colony to cool faster, better thermoregulatory behavior. And perhaps having undertaking variation inside of the nest might be more important than worrying about body sizes and who is better at it. Because technically, even if you're good at something, if you don't recognize it as something that you're supposed to do, you're not going to do it, and the colony isn't better for it, right? So if we look at body size variation, again, here it's really unclear as to what the benefits of maintaining that body size variation is. There was no relationship with thermoregulation. There was no relationship with undertaking behavior. That doesn't mean that there's no benefit to having body size variation in a colony. It just means that there are benefits to having that middle size in the nest. Because they seem to perform fairly well. We know, though, from other studies that large bees are often better at foraging tasks. I showed you my foraging arena. It wasn't very complex. They didn't really have to fly a lot. They didn't have to go very far. So maybe having them do some more foraging behavior might actually have some kind of effect on what they're doing. We also know from other studies in our lab that smaller bees are better at surviving longer periods of starvation. So they tend to have disproportionately more lipids, and often bumblebees living in temperate areas have to go through periods where they can't forage. So maybe there are some things that we're not parsing out from this study. But again, I'm not talking about the fact that there are no good reasons to have a wide range of body size. I'm saying that as far as colony performance in these two measurements, I didn't see anything. So to wrap this up, I showed that size variation did not really affect fanning or undertaking, or at least that wide range didn't. And that variation in thresholds did seem to affect colony performance. So what is the adaptive value of maintaining multiple types of variation? We go back to the beginning, we talked about how insects create these really elaborate patterns. And they do so by following individual simple rules and repeating those rules over and over. And we can create these really complex patterns over again by through simulations or through software. But we also know that they vary. I showed you, you know, the effects of body size variation or response threshold variation within the nest, but I also showed you in the very beginning how they also vary in terms of where they are inside of the nest, their dominance hierarchy. A lot of colonies will vary genetically. So what the question then remains is, if you incorporate this variation, we know that if you take an individual simple rule, you can make this. But if you incorporate the variation, what does this look like? And that is kind of what's been driving a lot of how I think about things now, is not necessarily in terms of how cool are the social insects that they can make this, but what will this look like when we start to put this in there? And I think we're starting to get close to that point where we can start to do that. So I want to thank you all for coming. I want to show off that I have an awesome committee that helped me work through a lot of these questions. And Anna, who would take me out looking for ants, and I didn't like ants then, so that was a feat. I have an awesome lab, Sarah, who's with me this week. She's right there. And some awesome funding, which helped me go to a lot of really great places and meet a lot of really fantastic people, including a lot of people already in this room. So thank you again very much for coming, and we got a little bit of time for some questions if you have some. So thanks.
Sure. Open for questions. I guess maybe flip the lights on.
Is there a correlation between size of the individuals and ovarial development? Oocyte development.
Right. So I measured the size of the oocyte, and so that was where the correlation was between body size and ovary development. There was still, so that was a strong correlation, but there was still a lot of variation
in
the
male population. Okay.
So all three of those having to do with oocyte development were triangular.
Mm-hmm.
So it said if you were really small or you were far away or whatever, no chance of having anything high. But it kind of opened up, and there were all sorts of possibilities, and you could have pretty much anything. That's where the wasn't so much of a correlation as kind of a conditional that at this end of the scale, lots of things are possible.
Yeah.
At that end, nothing. You know, basically, you're going to be low.
Right.
So one of the questions is whether if you combined these things, so if you had an individual who was near and was large and was old, is it additive or multiplicative? So you could now predict who was actually going to be lucky?
I think my conclusion was something to that effect. And I don't
know. Did you ever throw them into the same analysis to look at that?
I don't think I did, which is a shame. I did something similar to that, though. What I've done before is I've shown that larger individuals do tend to be on the outside. So I've shown correlations between these types before.
I'm thinking now we're at the individual differences.
Right.
Basis. So we're saying some of this is stochastic, right?
Where
you happen to be, what your size and stuff. But if by chance you have three check marks on the right side, right, would that pretty much, you know, that would give you more of a guarantee?
Right. I did the analysis, and I remember having this where I had the age and body size and ovary development all in one graph. And it did work out. The reason I took that out was because what happened was it did work out where the older and the larger ones were more likely to reproduce. This is how it worked. But the confusion came because people thought older bees were larger, and that wasn't the case. They stayed the same size.
Sure.
So that's why I separated them and presented them separately. But yeah, the older and larger are going to be more likely to reproduce. Right.
Do you have any hypotheses about why the colonies without extremes for body size were able to undertake at a better?
I think it has to do with the fact that I was removing for body size and I was removing for fanning threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what matters more is undertaking threshold. So I've seen every size of bee want to be an undertaker. And I've seen the smallest bees try to carry the largest bees out. They end up doing little backflips inside of the nest because they just can't carry them. But they try. And sometimes I feel like I just should take the corpse out so they don't have to worry about it anymore. I don't think it had a lot as much to do with the fact that middle-sized bees are necessarily better, because what we're seeing now is that it's very clear that larger bees, if the larger bees are going to undertake, they will spend more time, they more successfully remove them from the nest. But if you have colonies where the larger bees aren't necessarily going to be the undertakers, even though you still see a lot of it, you know, a lot of individuals trying to perform that behavior, they're not going to be as successful at removing them. So I think it has a lot more to do with the amount of just that threshold variation that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in a theoretical sense, if you have these two distributions and one of them is relatively flat, high variance, and one that has a narrow peak where they're all sort of in the middle, then whether or not, you know, one distribution will be able to handle a task better than the other depends on where on that axis you put the task. If it's, you know, temperature threshold, some temperature related thing, mm-hmm. Everyone can picture what my hands are doing here, then if you ask them to do, you know, an extreme task, then that, you know, that sharply peaked where everyone's in the middle group will have nobody who does that task,
mm-hmm.
and the broad range will have, you know, some that do that task. But if you actually push the task over to the other end, you will have a whole range as you get the task towards that middle group, where the middle group has got everybody doing the task,
mm-hmm.
and the extreme one still only has half doing the task.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether or not, am I making sense there?
Sorry.
Yeah, so whether or not, you know, a broad range actually handles the task better or not depends on whether it is an extreme task or an average task.
Right.
Right, if it's an average task, then if everybody's average, they can all do it, whereas having broad range means half of them can't do it because they're in the extreme in the other side.
Right,
so
I think the
yeah.
difference is that it's not so much that they can't do it, it's that they don't recognize that they need to do it. So I think that
yeah.
really fascinated me was the fact that there was this normal distribution of fanning thresholds. You would expect to have an even distribution, perhaps, that every individual, like that you have the same proportion of individuals responding as your temperature increases. And that way you have this regular and predicted type of whole colony level response where you have more and more individuals responding, as opposed to having this normal distribution where you have a few individuals responding at the lower temperature, everybody, you know, most of them responding when it gets sort of high, and then you've got the last little few that respond when you are just so high that you're at a critical state. So that really interested me, that there was that normal distribution of behavioral types within the nest. And I still I'm still kind of curious as to why that would be for a whole colony level performance. And then why you have those ends. Why not have everybody just kind of in the middle?
Is normal just the default though? For all biological variation,
you would think so.
It would take
yeah.
some really derived physiological mechanism to
yeah.
generate an even distribution
uh-huh.
to have, you know, equal numbers that are extreme and
yeah.
in both cases from the average. And so, usually when people are doing things where they're trying to figure out if there's some adaptive demography at the colony level, they're looking for something that's specifically different from normal as
right.
being an indication that something's going on other than just normal biological variation.
Right. And so, and that's true. However, what I thought was interesting was just, there was also those little, yes. But I also think it's interesting that, you know, there's some in the nest that are just always fanning. And some in the nest that are only fanning when they need to. And that the fact that there is a normal distribution of different temperatures was kind of what fascinated me too.
Is there any dominance relationship there? The big ones can pick the tasks they want to perform? I mean, is there any of that mapped into any of these dynamics?
So you don't really see a lot of dominance interactions before the queen dies. And for the most part, the larger ones are going to be the ones that are going to go out and do the more riskier tasks. So if they're the ones that are choosing a task, they might, and they want to stay inside and have that opportunity to reproduce, they would be more likely to stay inside, reserve their fat bodies, not have to do anything for the colony, and not have to risk being predated upon, get in trouble with rain, get lost, etc. Whereas instead, what you end up seeing is they're the ones that are fanning, which you know is probably metabolically expensive, but also they're guarding the nest, so they're going to be the ones that are going to go out and attack.
So there's no such thing as a preferred task.
Right, right. Nobody has seen a preferred task.
Okay, another question.
Except for egg laying.
So did they? Was this all in the laboratory?
Yes.
Could they? It was. Okay. And so you could keep maintain these year round, and there's I didn't have a sense of when one colony's you know ended
mm-hmm.
and the next one was founded and so forth.
Right. So what we would do is we would actually order our colonies from a distributor in Michigan, and so we could get colonies whenever we wanted, and set them up in our lab. So I can't say too much about the implications of this species that I referred to. Instead, I just kind of was looking at different patterns that were emerging inside of the nest. And generally what happened was colonies would live for about 2 to 3 months inside of the nest, or inside of the lab. And that was pretty similar to what they would probably do after the queen had already started laying eggs and had some workers out in the field. Because it's a pretty short season of growth for this particular species. So we would have maybe 3 to 4 months, depending on the experiment we were doing. For this last experiment, I would have them for a significantly less amount of time because I wanted to because I only had a short amount of, or a small amount, number of individuals, and I didn't want them to die before my experiment was over with. So for the last experiment, it was about a month and a half per colony I had. Mm-hmm.
Could you go back maybe a dozen slides? You had a picture, a graph from someone else's publication that showed fanning behavior.
Yeah.
So there, it looked like if it got too hot, a lot of individuals would stop fanning as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how well you can capture information about fanning behavior in your bees just by looking at one threshold, especially if you're just looking at at one measurement of the extreme, since extremes have messy distributions. I was wondering if you could talk about that method.
Absolutely. So what we know is that there's little correlation. There's two reasons bees are going to fan inside of the nest. It's either going to be because it's getting too warm inside of the nest, or it's going to be because there's an influx of carbon dioxide they need to fan it out. I believe in this paper they found no correlation with fanning for thermoregulation versus fanning for carbon dioxide. I tried to do carbon dioxide, and what happened was I ramped it up and I started measuring carbon dioxide inside of the nest. And what's really cool that happened was as soon as the carbon dioxide built up to a point right before my stopped measuring because it could only go up because it was set to test ants. Right before I could stop measuring, everybody stopped fanning. It was almost as if fanning would have taken and created more carbon dioxide. And they all just kind of stopped before they all passed out and died, which also happens when you put too much carbon dioxide in your bee nest. So because of those limitations that I had, I didn't pursue exploring the carbon dioxide factor any further with this one, but I wanted to. I wanted to look at a variety of different behaviors if I could have, and the correlations between those behaviors. I wanted to look at activity level. I wanted to look at all of these things, but I also needed a decent enough sample size, and it turns out 7 within each of my 3 treatments still wasn't as big as I wanted it to be. So that was an issue. With regards to the fanning, I think what's happening here is the same type of thing that might have been happening with that carbon dioxide. They just get hot, and I noticed the same thing when I started heating my colonies up. And I would try to keep them from getting too hot, because if they got too hot, it's not that they would necessarily die on me, but everybody would just panic a little bit. And when you start to heat them up, they're active a little bit more, they're moving around a little bit more, some are fanning, some are stopping, some are starting. It was just really neat, little interesting dynamic. But then you get it too hot and everybody just kind of stops and doesn't really know what to do, or they don't leave the nest. They always had an opportunity to leave. They never left the nest. They would just kind of shut down. And so I can't exactly explain what, and these, the temperatures that, I think my temperatures were a little bit higher only because my average in-nest temperature was generally higher than hers. But I think that might have been what was happening here too.
So you had bees that, this is back to the starting to produce larger ovaries,
mm-hmm.
That those same bees are also somewhat lazier than other bees.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to sound like they're cheaters.
Mm-hmm.
And they are at above a minimum age and a minimum size.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones that are further away from the queen, which unlike sort of age and size, that's something they could choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
So are they cheaters who have chosen to go further away from the queen and then, you know, even get less of the pheromone as some sort of active choice? Or do you think of them as cheaters? Or how do you sort of think about them in the whole evolutionary and social biology of this?
I wanted to think of them as cheaters at first.
Okay. Yeah.
And what ended up happening was, I mean, they still do perform tasks. And if something were to happen in the colony where they would have to step up and start doing something, they would most likely engage in a colony task.
Mm-hmm.
We often found, you know, just individuals at the periphery in general seem to be a little bit lazier than others. So while they could have been trying to escape that queen pheromone, which is possible, you still only see a small proportion of them actually getting away with that, or actually getting some kind of benefit from that. So at the colony level, why would there still be all of these lazy individuals if, you know, it's not good for the colony, which that's the level of unit of selection in social insects. So it wouldn't benefit the colony if everybody was trying to cheat. There's some level of policing that occurs if they try to reproduce too early. And a lot of aggression if they try to reproduce too early, they'll get kicked out of the nest. And you know, it's the likelihood of them being the ones, so you saw that whole range of, you know, big ones and old ones, and still a range of individuals that could be farther away from the queen. It's not a direct predictive thing that if you are one of these, you know, 10, 20 individuals on the outside, that you're going to be one of them that gets to reproduce, because it's only a small, maybe one or two, maybe five, that end up getting that opportunity. So I
well,
can't...
Well, it's something like you're getting older,
yeah.
And now, you know, there's still some chance that you will end up as an actual queen,
mm-hmm.
And as you're getting older, you know, it's and you have to be above a minimum size, mm-hmm. And as you get older, it reaches a point where you start to cheat more because you get
it is
the basic
possible.
Idea.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, so.
I guess just seeing the different ways and thinking about the different ways that cheating it comes about in other social insects, I would consider this, it seems like such a peaceful way to cheat.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's shading towards cheating. Subtle cheating.
Yeah, subtle cheating, exactly.
Yeah.
There's also that level of aggression that occurs right at that, it's called the competition point, right around the time that the queen starts dying or leaving the nest. And so it's typically the result of that aggression that determines this hierarchy among individuals. But it is possible that, and that's one of the ideas that we kind of came up with, is it could be a level of cheating, but it just could be, yeah. I don't know if they're actually thinking about, I'm going to sit over here and, you know, hold on to my fat body so that I might be able to reproduce someday, or if they just are bigger, older, lazier, and lucky.
I mean, it's a pretty big chunk of fitness, right? If you can produce some males, the
right.
To your sisters who don't have any.
Right. But with these guys, you know, taking care of your sister's offspring because they're so highly related,
right.
Isn't that bad of a deal? It's actually better to take care of your sister's offspring than to take care of your mom's offspring. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Do that right, or is that for?
That's the Hamilton story.
Yeah. Right. Which I don't really subscribe to too often, but or bring up too often. But basically, I mean, taking care of your sister's offspring is not the worst deal you could get.
What if the offspring are male, though?
All their offspring are going to be male.
Right. The Does the Hamilton story apply to male?
Right, it applies to, so, I don't think I have the brain cells to do the math right now, but yeah, it applies to how related you are to your sisters,
right.
To your nephews as well. But basically, I mean, there is, what is also really interesting, I think, too, though, is the fact that you see some increase in inactive behavior among those workers that don't get a chance to reproduce, but they still actually keep working. So even though they're not the ones that are getting any direct fitness from laying eggs, they're still doing something inside of the nest. And the colony is winding down. There's really not a lot of time left. So I often assume that they would all just stop working altogether. And they do really weird things when there's no queen. But they still actually do work as a cohesive group, which is pretty crazy.
I'm not sure how hive defense behavior is distributed within bumblebees, but when you introduce the corpses to groups, were they from the needle group? And if you did it, did you manipulate that at all to see if they responded differently or different individuals?
Yeah, I took, because of the fact that colonies produce very different averages and body sizes, and at the time that I was removing new individuals, they were producing, some colonies were producing some really small ones, some really big ones. So I took them, I mixed them all up, and they got dead bees from different colonies. So that's an aspect of the analysis that I haven't gotten a chance to look at. But we've been talking recently about hygienic behavior and the difference between your colonies, or individuals coming from your colony versus a different colony. And I did see some variation in the type of ways that they interacted with the corpses. Now, I don't know where the corpses exactly came from, but I saw some bees. I mean, like I said, some bees were really good and tried to carry them out. Some bees were really good and just tried. Some bees were really good at it, but they always carried them to the wrong end of the nest, and so they deposit them at the back of the nest instead of bringing them outside. Some bees would fight with others, and there would be a tug of war as to where they were pulling it. And I had one bee that would actually carry, amazing undertaker. She would carry it all the way back to the nest, and she'd dig a little hole, and then she'd plop it in there, and she'd cover it up, and then she'd go get another one. And so she never actually carried it out of the nest, but there was this incredible bearing behavior that I've never seen or heard of before in bees. And then we just did a paper about how they do that in ants, actually, too. So there was definitely variation in the type of undertaking behavior, as well as the magnitude of undertaking behavior that individuals exhibited in the nest. Whether that had to do with where the corpse came from is something that I haven't looked at yet.
Is it possible to just have the two from the nest go outside rather than to a foraging arena? Because what's
yes.
so troubling about studies where you have bumblebees on your desk
mm-hmm.
is that the foragers exert a huge amount of effort, and they run themselves to death. And they have, presumably they would die much faster if they had to go outside to forage, and some of them come home and some would get predated, and
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. And if you have a colony that has, so ant studies have this problem too, where you keep your ants on the desk and they start to get really lazy, and you can't tell if it's because they're old in a way that they wouldn't get old in nature, because the old don't, they don't die out in the field. And,
right.
Or will they abscond if you make the tube go outside?
I don't know about bumblebees. I know that
in these
bumblebees, I don't know exactly. I know my wasps, at any time I would put anything and give them an opportunity to go outside, they would go outside.
But
and I, oh, you know what? I did actually have some bumblebees. I had a few nests. I take those nests out. I don't put them in the analyses. There are a couple cases, yes, where the bees just don't like where I put them, and they walk out, and they actually start building honey pots in the foraging arenas.
I've seen that too. That makes
yeah.
you think that there is no such thing as a foraging arena. If they're building a pot
right.
in the arena.
If they're building a pot in the arena. For those colonies, I don't include those in my analyses. We've worked with them for so long now that we've reduced that type of behavior, because it's abnormal and it's incredibly frustrating.
So you've never tried to just have the tube go outside?
I can't have the tube go outside because I'm in Arizona.
And this is non-native.
Right. Right.
And you couldn't get like a native.
I finally found my first native bumblebee last spring after being in Arizona for almost 6 years. So, and I had looked, I climbed mountains and everything trying to find them. So, it's kind of hard to find them. And what I think would be, I think you're right. I think everything you're saying is absolutely correct. And what I've tried to do here is look and understand some, kind of just general patterns inside of the nest. Really trying hard not to focus on this foraging behavior as much as possible, because I don't think that the foraging behavior I'm seeing is all that natural.
But
right?
It drives the internal behavior.
Right, absolutely, because if you're losing some individuals to foraging pressures, you're going to have some fluctuation within the nest, and I think you're absolutely correct. I think one of the next steps after understanding this inside of the nest is actually taking them outside into a more temperate zone and studying them there, and ideally studying species that don't come from a company that has produced them. So I got, really spoiled, and I love my bumblebees, and I loved having the access to all of them, and I would never have this sample size if I were to do this as naturally as I try to do with wasps for my masters. So I think that there's a lot of stuff that we can start looking at here. I think when you start taking them outside and looking at them that way, you have a lot of other pressures that you have to deal with, of course, with regards to the behaviors that they're going to do. So I think having just kind of an idea of what they're doing inside of the nest, in the lab, next step going outside, and also looking at all of those different types of variation and including foraging pressures, I think that's incredibly important.
Maybe
you're right.
The big greenhouse.
I thought about the big greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was a reason I didn't do the big greenhouse, and I can't remember what that was. Oh, this was easier probably. So, you're right, and there are people that are using greenhouses now, yeah.
Well, you had them in the biodome at one time. You had bobbison patients there in Arizona. Under the biodome.
In the biosphere?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm wondering, there are two species of bumblebees, Bombus terrestris and Bombus impatiens,
mm-hmm.
about which we know quite a bit because
mm-hmm.
they are commercially reared.
Mm-hmm.
How generalizable do you think that your data are, or how do your data compare with what's known about terrestris, where you can make comparisons, and do you think that there are differences among bumblebees in the way that some species might organize themselves?
I think that the general organization patterns I saw are gonna carry over to terrestris because you still see the same type of nest distribution
mm-hmm.
of characters. You still see the same type of body size variation among individuals. This data from Anya Weidenmuller's lab is on terrestris.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest difference that I saw, and I didn't realize this until I went and saw some talks from people that were working on terrestris, so this wasn't even published yet, was that distribution of ovary development. When you remove the queen, almost all of the workers in terrestris, they're very aggressive and they just start fighting with one another, and you see all of this ovary development among those workers. Whereas in impatiens, I didn't see much aggression, in fact, hardly at all, and I saw very few individuals, even after giving them 2 to 3 weeks without the queen present, only a few individuals developing those ovaries. So the variation in aggressive behavior is gonna vary across colonies. The variation in worker reproduction is gonna vary across colonies. And the difference in genetic variation, because across bumblebees, the queen is gonna mate different amount of times. So I think that looking across species is going to be useful, but I think generally the patterns that you see inside of the nest, just the correlations with body size and everything, when you take away the aggressive and the reproductive factors, I think you're going to see some very similar patterns across
mm-hmm.
species.
Yeah, I was going to say that the concepts of switch point and competition points were developed around terrestris,
right.
where apparently a number of workers do develop their ovaries and start laying and producing males prior to the when the queen produces males.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And you see a little bit more policing, you see a lot more aggressive just behavior with regards to their worker reproduction, yeah.
Well, let's give Jenny another round of applause.